You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. HBO's The Lady and the Dale is a new four-part docuseries that traces the story of Elizabeth Carmichael, who rose to prominence when she released a fuel-efficient three-wheeled vehicle during the 1970s gas crisis. As she wins over major car makers and investors, a web of mystery unfolds regarding the car's technology and Carmichael's surprising past. A portrait of an extraordinary entrepreneur's rise and eventual fall, the series explores a one-of-a-kind story of fraud, family, and identity. And today I welcome executive producer Mark Duplass and director Zachary Drucker on the show to discuss this beyond belief story that covers everything from gender identity and trans trailblazers to Ayn Randian libertarianism, JPL rocket scientists, faking your own death, Jimmy Hoffa, the Cuban Revolution, and Tucker Carlson's dad. Coming up with Mark Duplass and Zachary Drucker in just a moment. The Lady and the Dale, a four-part documentary series from Emmy-winning producers Mark and Jay Duplass and directed by Nick Camilleri and Zachary Drucker, details the rise and fall of 1970s transgender entrepreneur Elizabeth Carmichael and her radical car, the Dale. This fascinating and genre-bending documentary premieres Sunday, January 31st at 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific on HBO, with new episodes airing subsequent Sundays at 9. And today I'm happy to welcome Zachary Drucker and Jay Duplass on the podcast to talk about this truly unbelievable story. Zachary and Jay, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Ben. Thanks so much for having us.
Now, I know that you both worked on the Amazon series Transparent. Is that where you first met?
Yeah, it is, actually. We hit it off, I think, on day one, and we'd always talked about doing something else together. And when The Lady and the Dale came across our desk for the first time, well, the first thought was, is this real? And the second thought was, we need Zachary Drucker stat.
And I should mention to the audience that, Zachary, you are a trans woman, and indeed much of your work is about discovering and preserving trans history, whether it's in the film space, photography, visual arts. When did you first learn about the person at the center of this story, Liz Carmichael?
Oh, well, thanks, Ben. Yeah, I am a deep enthusiast of trans history. I just voraciously devour any kind of remnants of our history as it can be found. And I had never heard of Liz Carmichael, not until Jay called me a year and a half ago and told me this wild story over the phone. And my interest was piqued. I think at first I wondered why this story, and Liz seemed so obscure that I really had a lot to learn. And ultimately, I came full circle and came to understand the ways in which Liz's story is grounded in themes that continue to impact trans life today, from her inability to access gender-related care, employment discrimination, you know, being incarcerated, being physically assaulted, being publicly humiliated in the media. So many elements of Liz's story are prescient today.
Now, you've said before that you feel that you have a political duty to share these stories in your art. The fact that you didn't even know about this story until it was mentioned to you makes me wonder, you know, when you have that job of uncovering trans history and telling these stories, it seems to me that it must be especially difficult when so much of that history until very recently was kept in the shadows, wasn't documented by the media, and in large part, you know, really wasn't even spoken about or acknowledged.
Absolutely. I mean, I've always noticed that the history of trans and gender expansive people is largely an oral history that is like passed down only if you're in conversation with elders. And that's always, you know, having intergenerational friendships, I think, has been a really important component to my development as a human and as an artist. I think I understand Liz through those friendships in many ways, having known elders and icons such as Holly Woodlawn, Flawless Sabrina, and many others. I think it kind of prepared me to understand Liz, who came from, you know, she was born in 1927. She's and old enough to be a grandparent to me. And the generational space, I think, between her life and mine is just this chasm that is kind of fascinating to explore.
Now, Jay, I'm interested that this wasn't something that originated with Liz. You guys brought it to her. What drew your brother and you to this project?
Well, you know, I think when the materials first came across our desk, that was, you know, Nick Camilleri, Zachary's co-director, sent them to us. And, you know, we were just, our interest was piqued. You know, Liz is a riveting character, and the twists and turns that were being hinted at the time, because they weren't even fully investigated at that time yet, were as bountiful and as exciting as the story ended up being. And, you know, but we Googled it and we couldn't find anything, as you said. You know, I mean, and what we've learned from Zachary in this process is that trans history has been erased. But I mean, I would just say that, you know, in the last doc series that we did, Wild Wild Country, you know, the sort of feedback that really resonated the most with audiences is that Sheila, the lead character, you know, was,
right,
you know, people were talking about her like she was one of the most fascinating people to ever appear in cinema, you know, just so complicated, so smart, so wily, so mysterious. And, you know, I think Liz was just ringing that bell. I mean, yeah. I think, you know, Liz is definitely going to give Sheila a run for her money.
Yeah.
It's just a fascinating story. It's just a fascinating, incredible story. And it's so timely, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, in a weird way, I've never even thought about it, because it's just so obvious when you hear some of the elements of the story, you're like, oh my God, this is just an incredible story. And the fact that, you know, we might have an opportunity to illuminate some really important things that need to be discussed culturally, socially,
I will tell you, I was a huge fan of Wild Wild Country. Just completely blew my mind. And you and Mark, you've sort of cornered the market on the Stranger Than Fiction docuseries now, with Wild Wild Country and Evil Genius and now Lady in the Dale. Do you see your growing body of work in the documentary space as being reflective of your own style? Or are there certain hallmarks to a Duplass Brothers documentary?
Yeah, I mean, Mark and I used to always say that if documentaries didn't make you exhausted and broke, we would make more of them. you know, we came up making very realistic narrative pieces, nonfiction, or at least, like, you know, very, very intensely based on real life. Mm-hmm. And our primary influences have always been documentaries. I mean, my three favorite films from last year are documentary films. So I think there's definitely just a deep love there. But I would just say that, you know, also, I mean, you know, we're not necessarily like hunting down anything specific. Things kind of come to us. And for us, it's the right mix of just fascinating stories, fascinating human beings, and then really good human beings to work with. That's kind of our, that's kind of our MO is like no assholes policy, no matter how good the story is or whatever. So, you know.
Well, let's dig into this incredible story. Prior to transitioning, Liz Carmichael was a man named Jerry Michael. What can either of you tell us about those years and who Jerry Michael was?
You know, Liz, before she transitioned, was very bombastic, I would say. She moved from town to town. She had a number of failed marriages and children until finding her fourth and final wife, Vivian Michael. They had five kids together. And at that point, early in their marriage, had both been implicated in a counterfeiting operation in Los Angeles and were wanted on federal charges, and thus began a, I guess, 13-year period of living on the run and trying to evade the FBI. Over that span of time, you know, the FBI invested a tremendous amount of resources to apprehend Liz. And during that time, she transitions in the 60s. She starts living and presenting as a woman. I think it's easy sometimes to forget that Liz was trans before that too. She just wasn't presenting as her truest self. But it's one of the things that we did not include in the documentary that I love is that the FBI didn't have the imagination to put together that Jerry Dean Michael was Elizabeth Carmichael, because they continued to follow Vivian, was his wife. And the files, they literally are saying, Vivian's living with Elizabeth Carmichael. We couldn't find any information about who she is. And they never put it together. And then can I throw in another quick point? I just was listening to Jay talking about the medium of documentary. And I had this thought that, you know, trans stories, it's very easy to kind of claim that they are this invention of coastal, you know, liberals and progressives. And there's a tremendous amount of value in real historical figures. They're impermeable. You can't argue with the life that this woman led. It's, you know, not like, it is stranger than fiction, absolutely. But it's also empirically true. You know, she lived this life. It was completely unique to live. Like, there was no, and I mean, that's part of what I love about being trans is that we are kind of, we have to create our own universes. You know, like, we are completely self-created, and Liz's version of that is just very unexpected and very much a product of her time.
I guess Jerry Michael, and then as Liz Carmichael, spent probably more time on the run, I would imagine, than they spent settled in one place, which I imagine must have been hard for her wife and family, although the wife then became the aunt when she became the mommy. How did the children remember those years on the lam?
You know, mostly we included, you know, we included their feelings about being on the lam in the doc, but I think it was difficult. Yeah. I mean, it's so hard, I think, to imagine any other way, you know, like the life, the family that you're born into is inescapable. Like, you'll never outrun that, regardless of how many times you move. And I think that Liz's actions, you know, had repercussions for her children. And,
so they seem to have very fond memories of her as well.
You know, everybody who met Liz loved her.
Wonderful parent. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's such an unusual life that she led, you know, always being on the run. And, you know, there's so many different angles of this and different stories. It's a little bit hard to tell what's real, what's hyperbole, what's an outright lie, what might not be true, but maybe she sincerely believed to be true. And a perfect case in point here is she makes this wild claim that when she was Jerry Michael, she was part of a covert operation running guns to Fidel Castro's rebels in the 50s and even got jailed by the Cuban dictator Batista. Now, I don't know what to make of that. Jay, were you guys ever able to verify if that was true or not? What do we make of that?
No, I don't think that's verifiable.
Okay.
I think that's what's so mysterious and complicated about Liz, and what's so great about the story is Liz definitely threw up smoke screens, you know. Mm. Liz was definitely involved in some questionable behaviors and practices against the law. I think what's interesting is that, you know, the media, you know, started to confound that with her transness, which is, mm-hmm. was really an error and just really like a really cheap shot way to sort of take her down. There's so many angles to it, and there's so many projects that she had, from, you know, running, an aquarium out of the basement of her home, which sounds very, very true, to, you know, the thing that we haven't even talked about yet in this podcast is that right. She invented a three-wheeled car during the oil and gas crisis. That's why you guys got to watch these documentaries, because we could talk forever about one of five elements of this story. But, you know, what's so fascinating is that, you know, half the time you are really questioning her motives, you're questioning what's true, what's not true. And you know, the other half of the time, for me, at least personally, there's no doubt in my mind that Liz wanted to alleviate America's suffering. I mean, Liz was a major underdog her entire life. I mean, just being born in the Midwest in 1927 and trying to come to terms with who you really are, and then trying to have the courage to present it, you know, like the profound, I mean, you know, the way I've been thinking about it and talking about it nowadays is that, you know, who's more American than Liz Carmichael? You know, I mean, she struggled every day to express herself fully, to achieve the American dream. Mm-hmm. And shit was stacked against her the entire time. And she fought like hell, and she wore a smile. And it's really, it's so inspiring. But yes, Wiley, and necessarily so. I mean, and let's be honest, like, it's not just in the last century that trans people, or in the last history of mankind, humankind, that trans people have had to struggle in order to not be killed. It's still happening. So,
yeah,
you know, she came up under very, very different circumstances.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. And what's remarkable is, here is a woman and a mother of five with zero automotive experience, no engineering degree, in Los Angeles, not Detroit. She was able to quickly build a car company totally out of the blue. I think when I was talking to Zachary earlier, I think basically in the span of 2 months, get America all jazzed about this car, the Dale, and even start pre-selling cars before they have a working prototype. How does one do that? Is it just a testament to her force of personality or what?
Gumption. Liz had gumption. Yeah.
For sure.
And honestly, you know, those characteristics continue to play out in the tech industry and in the entrepreneurial realm in general. Liz was not doing anything different than what Elon Musk or Elizabeth Holmes has done in recent years. I mean, to be an entrepreneur, you have to overpromise and sell an idea before it's complete. Liz is kind of a humble beginning, actually, to so many phenomenons that have continued to, you know, reverberate through time.
Now let's talk about this car. What made the Dale unique?
Well, you know, it's coming out at a time in the early 1970s, where, you know, cars are as big as they've ever gotten, and we have an oil and gas crisis, and people are waiting in lines for a half a day to fill up their cars, and the entire economy is built upon people's ability to drive themselves to work. So, you know, Liz saw an incredible opportunity, definitely wanted to become a billionaire, but also definitely wanted to help out. And so the car is essentially an incredibly lightweight three-wheeled vehicle that, you know, predecessor of, like, you know, your early Prius. I mean, it wasn't a plug-in, but it was just, you know, intended to get about 70 miles to the gallon. And if it could have happened, and I tend to think it could have happened. Absolutely. Did she put cart before the horse? Absolutely. But do you have to, an invention is in your mind before it can be a reality. And like you said, she had some major players on her team quickly. Yeah. So, you know, ultimately, you know, she was trying to get America moving again. And this car was a really great possibility at doing it, but never quite got there.
Yeah, and she was just a master promoter. And one thing that we hear from her over and over again is Detroit does not want this car to be made. The big three are going to do anything and everything legal and illegal to shut us down. I wonder, was that just hype, or do you think Detroit automakers really took the deal seriously, Zachary?
I think it was bluster. I think it was Liz's kind of grandiose idea. But she had really, I mean, Liz was not the first independent auto manufacturer in America. There's
right.
so many
yeah. Tucker,
well-known,
yeah.
Preston Tucker, DeLorean.
Right.
Oh, there's the gentleman who just passed away this year. I'm forgetting his name at the moment. There's been many, and there's also been three-wheeled cars before. Liz
right.
was, you know, not the first. The origin of the Dale and the namesake of the Dale actually came from an inventor in the Valley named Dale Cliff, who had modified his motorcycle, which is why it got 70 miles to the gallon and why it was a lightweight chassis to, you know, carry the vehicle. So hypothetically, it was possible, you know, like she just didn't quite carry it to the finish line. I, you know, there was no evidence that we could find, and we looked pretty deep in terms of any kind of public records from those years from the big three Detroit auto manufacturers, and we couldn't find any trace, which doesn't okay. mean that they weren't talking about it, but certainly it was never in print that
okay.
it was on their radar. I think Liz pointed often to the Tucker as a cautionary tale of how the government could dismantle or how the big three
right.
could influence local politicians in Detroit to you know, to dismantle an independent car maker.
Yeah.
So I think she kind of used it strategically, but it's hard to find any evidence of
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Yeah. Her politics was interesting because, you know, in the film, she talks about her Ayn Rand being her favorite author, and she espouses these right wing beliefs in the sanctity of the free market. Her politics in some ways seems surprisingly conservative from a trans woman, but is that libertarian streak fairly compatible with being LGBT? That idea of leave me alone, you know, mind your own business, you know?
Absolutely. Susan Stryker makes such a salient point in the series that Liz's resentment for regulation and big government kind of dovetailed perfectly with her trans identity. She was a trans person who had no identity documents. She had no legitimate. And so libertarianism provided a cover for her to some extent to say like, oh, the reason why we're not selling options with a permit, the reason why we haven't done, you know, all of the things that companies have to do in order to operate was because of her libertarian ideology.
Yeah.
But it was also a kind of convenient excuse for her own inability to provide evidence of who she was. So yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you know, LGBTQI folks are all over the map. I have no idea where Liz would be today. I know that later in her life, she would go to meetings of the survivors of the Waco, Texas shooting, for example. And so she had these, she really identified, I think, with that community.
Yeah. But she might have also had a little bit of a conspiracy streak, I guess, if she was kind of involved
probably
with that crowd.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Funny.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah, if you're born a trans woman in the Midwest in 1927, I think you're going to inherently feel like everything's against you.
Someone's
like the entire system
is
rigged against you.
Totally. So. And some of the claims that Liz made about the Dale were, you know, as you already mentioned, that it would get 70 miles per gallon, that it was a three-wheel car that wouldn't flip when it took tight corners at high speeds, and that it was made of indestructible plastic. In fact, I think she claimed it was bulletproof. Jay, were any of these claims true?
There are some pretty intense investigations that happen inside the series that disprove at least a few of those things. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, she was selling hot air and selling it like hotcakes, you know, I mean, people wanted to buy this thing, man. You know, I mean, I think the truth is I can't remember how much she was selling it for. It was in a $1,000 to $2,000 range. You know, I think people probably thought
it was less
than
a
Ford Pinto.
It would have been like the most affordable car. Yeah.
If this thing can do a quarter of what Liz is saying it can do, it's still going to be a great deal. You know, but I mean, she was absolutely, and I think there's a manic rise there too, because you know, that period of her life where she settled into Los Angeles, she was, you know, they had money. They were living a nice little suburban Los Angeles life, and money was just pouring into her offices. And I think, you know, she got a little ahead of herself. Like, you know, I think maybe one of the few times where there was such a thing as bad press or as too much press.
I want to ask you guys about some of that money that was pouring into the office, because some of the engineers who you talked to in this film, some of whom had been rocket scientists working on this car and really believed in it, some of them recall stacks of cash, shady, seemingly mobbed up thugs always hanging around the office. And I'm really intrigued by this, what's implied to be an organized crime angle to this. Now, the mafia is not exactly known for their open-mindedness, nor their tolerance for getting scammed. So I have to wonder, did they know Liz was trans? Were they in on the whole car scheme, or were they just unwitting investors like other people? Or do you have any idea?
Yeah, I mean, I'll answer. I mean, I think that it's easy to assume or expect that the mafia was not necessarily familiar with trans people, but the truth is that there's actually a long history of mafiosos having trans girlfriends on the side. It comes from southern Italy with the travestis, as being kind of a status symbol, and, you know, having a wife but also having a travesti on the side. And that's a long tradition. So, and then of course the
and
mafia,
also didn't the mob would fund gay bars as well. They were like, was a great cash cow for them because they weren't sanctioned. So the mob would help set them up.
Right. Yeah. It's like running a speakeasy. Same deal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there is, I mean, you would never, like, you'd never expect that to be the case. But the truth is that the mafia was always kind of in bed with the trans community in this very concealed and kind of clandestine way. So there's that. I don't think Liz fits into that legacy exactly, because she was coming from such a different place in life as a patriarch, as a, you know, as a father to these kids, etc. We tell a very accurate story about Liz. We did not include anything that we couldn't verify or that we thought maybe wasn't true, and there's a lot of hearsay. I mean, we had people on camera saying that she was close with the mobster who disappeared.
You're not talking about Jimmy Hoffa.
Jimmy Hoffa.
Oh, exactly. Jimmy Hoffa. Oh, well, that would make sense because he was involved with the car unions and all that. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. That would make everybody sense. Listening to this is screaming Jimmy Funny. Hoffa and it's like, wow. It's taking them so long. So,
that is wild.
You know, we had people on camera claiming that Liz was very tight with Jimmy Hoffa. And sure enough, Liz was in Detroit some of the same times that Hoffa would have been there. I mean, it's not impossible, but we couldn't verify it. There was nothing. And when it comes to any ties to organized crime, it's not verifiable, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, we looked, the FBI files gave us a lot of clues. They, you know, there's a huge file on Liz Carmichael, thousands of pages. Mm-hmm. I never thought I'd read so many FBI files in my life.
Yeah, I mean, there are just so many twists to this and so many interesting characters that come into play. You know, I won't give it away, but at some point, Tucker Carlson's dad even enters the picture. But eventually, the law catches up to Liz Carmichael, and she's arrested, I think, while she's on the run in Miami, held in a men's jail, even though she identified and dressed as a woman. Do you think that that was cruel and unusual punishment to put her in that kind of situation at that time?
Hands down, absolutely. And it still happens today.
Yeah.
Wow. In her trial, do you think that the fact that Liz was trans prejudiced the jury against her?
Without a doubt. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say without a doubt. I mean, these folks had probably never seen a trans person in real life. People knew the story of Christine Jorgensen, who was the first person to become famous for transitioning in the 1950s. But very few people entered, you know, a media space after Jorgensen until Renee Richards, who, of course, is also linked to Liz in a surprising and interesting way.
Yeah. And in the media and among the public, there arose this narrative that her life as a woman was just some kind of alias or disguise that she created to evade the law. And I mean, the timing of her choosing to transition, I can see might, you know, at that time when she was on the run, faked her own death as Jerry Michael, would seem a little suspicious. So in some sense, I kind of get it. But on the other hand, she lived as a woman her whole life. Jay, do you think that that sort of gives lie to this theory that her identity as a trans woman was some kind of ruse?
Yeah, I think the way that it plays out in the end is not only fortifying of who she really was, but it turns out to be a really powerful and heartwarming result, which is yet another twist and turn of what's so wonderful about this story. But yeah, I mean, you know, who's to say that, I mean, it probably, I can't imagine what it would take to really come out and start, you know, presenting yourself as the woman that you are when at this time in history, when no one is going to be friendly to it, you're going to be hunted, you know? So, you know, it's possible that she needed a little push, you know, because I think, you know, what we learn is it takes a lot of people a whole lifetime to get there, you know, because of what you're up against. So, but yes, the way that the story winds up, I think, is really beautiful.
Now, one silver lining to all this is, as far as I know, the trial of Liz Carmichael was the first time in any trial, perhaps in any kind of government proceeding in the U.S. up to that point, that a judge, a government official, publicly recognized a trans individual's gender identity and, in fact, even ordered others in that courtroom to acknowledge and respect her as a woman. Zachary, how significant was that event in the history of the trans community?
Oh, I mean, I think it's a blip. I don't, you know, I think that this series will probably be many, many people's first, you know, knowledge of Liz and her story and the ways in which, you know, the many firsts that Liz was. I mean, I think that there is a lot of material to mine in that, like Liz's entanglement with law enforcement and with the judicial system and with being incarcerated in a men's prison. And that's still playing out from state to state. Trans women are often still housed in men's prisons in most states in America. We include one kind of silver lining moment in the last episode, which is the men's prison where Liz was housed in her second prison sentence now has trans inmates are able to self-identify as women. There's a cohort of them, there's a group of them. And so we kind of included that as another marker of progress, though it's still, I think, disconcerting that trans women are disproportionately incarcerated and mm-hmm. have to turn to survival crimes in order to live and to mm-hmm. eat. So many of those themes continue. We present it in the series and they're just as relevant today.
Yeah, and you brought up something interesting that comes up in this documentary is it's an interesting perspective on her criminal past, because in those days, it was nearly impossible for a person to be openly trans and hold a job in this country. So many transsexuals, right. as with other marginalized groups in America, took to larceny or petty crime. You know, those were their only options. I'd love to hear more about that side of this story.
I think it's very succinctly summarized in the first episode. There's a woman who's a sex worker in the Tenderloin. This is in the 1960s. And she lays it out for, I believe, like a city council or a community gathering. And she says, I would be happy to work in a legitimate space of employment. I've been turned away from any number of places who will simply not hire me. And, I would go hungry if I hadn't turned to sex work. Incidentally, that footage is shot by Dick Carlson, the person who ends up outing Liz, which was a very unexpected kind of divine intervention. Like, we had used this footage because we were like, okay, here's a trans woman from the past talking about employment discrimination. Lo and behold, it's Dick Carlson's footage from years before meeting Liz. So in some ways, I had always suspected that Carlson had encountered trans people, which is how he was able to identify Liz.
Oh, interesting.
As trans, that it was in Carlson's imagination. And I didn't answer your question at all.
No, that's okay. That's okay. You may not be able to say it, but I'll say it. Tucker Carlson's dad, Dick Carlson, kind of comes off, seems like a bit of an asshole, frankly. Now, I wonder, what do you say to the people, particularly within the trans community, who may say, we don't want to be associated with a swindler. We already have it hard enough as is. The last thing that we need is someone exalting Liz Carmichael as some kind of poster child for trans people.
I would say that we do not exalt Liz Carmichael, that we tell a really fair and mm-hmm. accurate story about her, and that all of us, that we as trans and gender expansive people are allowed to be full humans who mm-hmm. make mistakes and who make questionable decisions. Really investing in Liz's story has given me a personal sense of allowance and permission to be flawed and to break free from the restraints of respectability, which I think is a standard that so many marginalized people are held to, that we have to be these perfect messengers. And, we have to kind of, live impermeable lives. Like, mm-hmm. I just am excited to be as messy as I want to be in the future, and to not be held to like an unrealistic standard that other people are not. Yeah.
Yeah, it's such a terrific documentary series. And you know, I really do hope that, you know, we still have a long way to go. I hope that it changes some hearts and minds and opens some people's eyes out there. And I also want to say that I absolutely loved the way you use photo collage animation to tell this story. It's so inventive, so unique. I don't think I've ever seen that in a documentary. Real quickly before we go, I want to ask you both, do you think that Liz would have been able to pull off the Dale given a little more time?
Jay, what do you
think? I don't see why not. I don't see why not. I mean, I don't know what pull off really means, but I don't see why she couldn't, and her team could not have put together a three-wheeled car that was cheap and light. It might have been super dangerous, but you know, it wouldn't have been more dangerous than a motorcycle. You know,
yeah. True.
I might be in the minority here, but I just feel like anything's possible. Anything, guys. Mm-hmm. We're driving around in things that we plug into our garages right now. It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy. So good anything's point. Possible.
Yeah. What about you, Zachary?
Ultimately, I hope that people are asking these questions over dinner and having these conversations, and that, you know, there's a lot of room for interpretation in this story. Like, you know, and in making it, I think our hope was always like for people to be asking, was Liz really going to make this car? Was it another one of her schemes? Could she have done it? Was the car viable? All of those are things that we continue to discuss, honestly, as a team. Like, we continue to kind of debate. It's all there.
This is just a fascinating wild ride of a docuseries. The Lady in the Dale premieres again Sunday, January 31st at 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific on HBO. Also available on HBO Max, with new episodes airing subsequent Sundays at 9. Zachary Drucker and Jay Duplass, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks so much, Ben.
Thanks again to Zachary and Mark for coming on the show. You can watch the first episode of The Lady in the Dale on HBO On Demand or on HBO Max. And don't miss new episodes airing every Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern on HBO or HBO Max. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.